Warning, the following ZipRecruiter radio spot you are about to hear is going to be filled with F-words.
When you're hiring, we at ZipRecruiter know you can feel frustrated, forlorn even, like your efforts are futile, and you can spend a fortune trying to find fabulous people, only to get flooded with candidates who are just fine. Fortunately, ZipRecruiter figured out how to fix all that. And right now, you can try ZipRecruiter for free at ziprecruiter.com/zip. With ZipRecruiter, you can forget your frustrations because we find the right people for your roles fast, which is our absolute favorite F word. In fact, 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day.
Fantastic.
So, whether you need to hire 4, 40, or 400 people, get ready to meet first-rate talent. Just go to ZipRecruiter.com/zip to try ZipRecruiter for free. Don't forget, that's ZipRecruiter.com/zip. Finally, that's ZipRecruiter.com/zip.
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job post seen on other job sites. With Indeed Sponsored Jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/PODKATZ13. Just go to Indeed.com/PODKATZ13 right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
Welcome to the Blunt Business here on CannabisRadio.com. Thank you all for joining us. Powered by TheBuzzCRM.com. I'm not going to go into the commercial right now because I want to go and table that until a little bit later, because we need to go ahead and talk more about some real important news. I know in the last 6 months of the program, it feels like the common trend among either legal counsel or advocates or business owners that we've talked to on the program, since we know there has been a pause in the descheduling case that administrative law judge John Mulrooney was presiding over until now, most recently, he has made the decision to resign as of August 1st, as we record this program. Now we're going to wait and see what happens as a new DEA chief has been sworn in. He has been confirmed, Terrence Cole, and see where they go with this. But there's been a lot of talk about that part that finally gives us some wishful thinking about what could be of the future for cannabis and where we might go with it, because I think that's the part that people need to go and hear from now. Finally, some changes going on within this current presidential administration and the cabinet that we have. We finally have a few things that have finally allow us to see a possible trajectory where cannabis could be descheduled and maybe something happens, because there's a lot of things right now in flux that we're hearing about. Nothing has been implemented yet, but here to go and talk about this evolving landscape of cannabis policy, particularly in light of the recent confirmation of DEA Administrator Terrence Cole, looking at potential impact of cannabis rescheduling, distinction between illicit and regulated markets, and the role of science and information and enforcement clarity in shaping a more modern drug policy. And welcome back a friend of the program, the CEO of New Lake Capital Partners, Anthony Coniglio, back on the Blunt Business. Welcome back.
Thank you. Thanks for having me back. It's great to be with you.
So going through what we have already talked about just a minute ago, if you're not aware, again, it's already been announced where Terrence Cole now is in. And of the latest that we have as of press time talking about this, Cannabis Business Times reports that Terrence Cole has not included rescheduling among his 8 strategic priorities upon being sworn in, which is a U-turn from what he might have said during his confirmation here. We don't know what that's all going to go into, but the thing was, earlier this week, he did release a list of his top 8 strategic priorities, reflecting a renewed focus on enforcement, partnership, and public safety to meet the evolving threats of the global drug crisis. So we don't know what's going to happen, where the DEA is going to stand on the proposed rule to reclassify cannabis, which came from the Biden administration last year. HHS, referring to DEA, and the DEA administrator has changed his order of operations, according to what they're saying here.
Right.
So The more urgent matters are fighting foreign terrorist organizations, targeting drug traffickers, and dismantling Mexican cartels, illicit fentanyl manufacturers. And for him, he was a special agent of DEA prior to, and that's, I can understand where enforcement is more the direction than looking at the scheduling. So, I mean, I don't think that his announcement of what priorities are is a reason to go ahead and feel doom and gloom again. I just think that there are priorities put in place, but I think it's also because of what can be immediately be done. In the meantime, we have to wait for another ministry to law judge to be appointed or some other route to see where descheduling goes. But Anthony, just again, starting with you, now the rescheduling of the Schedule 3 can help federal authorities pursue TCOs. I'm not sure what those TCOs are, but you can help me to define that.
Yes.
Exploring the state federal disconnect of cannabis laws, how do you think this plays out operationally for the DEA, specific challenges that might arise in distinguishing between legitimate businesses and illicit operations, even under a new scheduling?
Yeah. Well, listen, as we start this conversation, let's just make the observation that anybody in this industry is really sitting on their edge of the seat without having a policy statement from this administration to know which way it's going to go. We're all sitting here on the edge of our seats looking for a signal, looking for a smoke signal on what direction this is going to go. And so anything that happens, people analyze and reanalyze over and over. But let's pull all these pieces apart, and I'll give you my overall perspective, which is I'm definitely tilting more in the optimistic side. I'm not saying it's going to happen, but I'm more optimistic than I am pessimistic. We can leave it at that. And so everybody is excited that we have a new DEA administrator on the surface. However, when you look at his background and his history and even his public statements around cannabis, you'd scratch your head and say, well, why the heck is this industry excited to have Terrence Cole, somebody who is on the record saying he doesn't like marijuana and is perceived to be a longtime prohibitionist and really, as you pointed out, a career DEA enforcement agent? Why would people be excited about that, right? Because you would think it would just be more of the same. Well, I think people are getting excited because this rescheduling process was stalled. And by him coming back into this, since the ALJ put the issue, there was a legal question that came up in the process that the ALJ had to put back to the DEA administrator. So without an acting administrator, there wasn't going to be resolution. So now you have an administrator. Now you can hopefully get to a resolution. And of course, people were hoping that there would be a positive resolution. But as you pointed out, ALJ, the judge Mulrooney, announced his retirement shortly after the confirmation of Terrence Cole. So where does that leave us? Well, you pointed out, could they appoint another judge? My understanding is there aren't any other ALJs within the DEA. And due to some other Supreme Court rulings with respect to the constitutionality of ALJs and other legal issues around the ALJ system, it's my understanding this administration won't be looking to staff administrative law judges in many of these departments. And so you now have a situation where if you don't think there'll be an ALJ that'll be appointed at the DEA, then that proceeding won't move forward, and you'll have Administrator Cole sitting with the decision around rescheduling squarely in his lap. However, we know from looking at the proposed rule, it was the Department of Justice that made the proposed rule last year. And so there's a lot of confusion, and we're all trying to look at these tea leaves around which way is this rescheduling going to go. And then you have this priority list that came out that you talked about, and a lot of people are wringing their hands over the fact that cannabis was not on a list of priorities. I have a couple of things to say about this. Number one, and I wrote about this recently. If you look at the National Drug Threat Assessment, which is a report that the DEA submits to Congress every year and was submitted, I believe it was May of this year, it is the list of priorities for the DEA. And top of that list is these transnational criminal organizations.
Actually, TCO. Just read exactly from that article that you're talking about here. This is really good prior to the confirmation, but still, the National Drug Threat Assessment places cannabis well behind synthetic drugs and perceived threat. And this, that cannabis is largely in the context of illicit cultivation operations by transnational criminal organizations, STC, that exploit gaps between state and federal laws and use banned pesticides that pose environmental and public health hazards. And the emphasis is now on the harms caused by TCOs, not cannabis use itself, but the DEA, and this is can change, but it explicitly links the same transnational criminal organizations responsible for fentanyl trafficking to illicit cannabis operations.
That's right.
The reason they put that together, that there's a change of the narrative that cannabis has to have before we can really see, because that narrative has to get taken out or has to be transmogrified so that cannabis can be looked at for rescheduling.
Right. And in that piece, I talk about how I looked back at the National Drug Threat Assessment from a decade ago and compared how did the DEA talk about marijuana 10 years ago versus today. There is a 75% reduction in the usage of the term in the entire report. 10 years ago in the summary, it was referred to over and over again. This year in the summary, there's no mention of cannabis in it. So there's definitely a narrative change. But back to these priorities. So this threat assessment literally sets forth the list of priorities for the DEA. And so when we look at what Terrence Cole came out and said his priorities were going to be, hey, guess what? Not surprising, very, very consistent with the National Drug Threat Assessment, which, hey, by the way, these TCOs, Mexican cartels and Chinese cartels that define the TCOs, that's also the number one threat under the National Intelligence Threat Assessment. So think CIA, think NSA. It's their report to Congress every year. And for the first time ever, these transnational criminal organizations, these Chinese cartels and Mexican cartels, show up at number one on the list ahead of Iran, ahead of Russia, and ahead of North Korea. So just think about that. This is, from a law enforcement and intelligence community perspective, the number one threat to America. So it's not surprising to see that would be the focus. And then lastly, in terms of this list coming from Cole, I've heard somebody phrase it as this was his enforcement priorities. So shouldn't we be happy that marijuana wasn't even mentioned, since this was not a to-do list? This was a priority list of enforcement action.
But now this first priority is being addressed, and it was being done well before the DEA administrator got confirmed, because you have the fact that, you know, Mexican banks were being sanctioned. The little cartel has been put in through a lot of heat right now for what they've been doing out there. Also, the trade deal with China, trying to go and stop from any fentanyl trafficking from China coming in. Also, the control of immigration right now on the border, on both northern and southern borders, has been very little any kind of immigration at all. Any kind of, you know, crossing the border illegally, that's all been taken out. So he's already got so much that's already there. It's just enforcement at this point. So the major problem, I would think, in the first 6 months of the administration, that was something that President Trump ran on. It's being done. It's obvious that he's gone after, and now Mexican troops have just been deployed to the U.S. border to crack down on fentanyl. So again, all these different things, these outlying sources are coming in to address this first priority, next priority.
Yeah, so I don't think any of this is negative on the surface. I just come back to where I started, which is we do not have a policy statement out of this administration relative to cannabis. And that's what we really need. We need to see, will there be a policy statement? Will it be a comprehensive one? Will it be rescheduling and nothing? Or will it be rescheduling coupled with more of a regulatory framework? That's what I'm optimistic for, is that we'll finally have the federal government recognize that it can't keep its head in the sand relative to this product. Because we always have to remember, Gallup and Pew, those polls consistently show that roughly 90% of Americans believe that cannabis should be legal for medical purposes, and roughly 2/3 believe for recreational purposes. There are very few things we agree on to that extent in this country. And I think it's about time the federal government catches up. So hopefully, right, my hope is that we see a more robust regulatory approach, which, hey, by the way, if you move this to Schedule 3 and you implement the reporting requirements that the DEA has and the registration requirements that the DEA has for anybody that operates with Schedule 3 substances, I've got to think that can help identify the legal players, the state legal players, from the illicit TCOs, and help the enforcement actions that you're seeing take place across this country.
Cannabis Business Times yesterday, as we're recording, put out a great story to kind of give the full context of where we are with the successor to John Mulroney, this ALJ that was being tasked to go and handle things here. Now, upon retirement, the successor will pick up full jurisdiction over the hearing process. As soon as Terrence Cole fixes a briefing schedule to allow for the hearing's designated participants to weigh in on the interlocutory appeal stemming from pro-scheduling participants, the DA colluded with rescheduling participants, anti-rescheduling, through proper ex parte communications. And, you know, that was the whole Perkins Coie thing that was going on a couple months ago. But there were still certain motions that were being pushed together, procedural motions. There were certain things that were kind of moving the ball along. But we already got the case that's been coming in. And then Cole sets the briefing schedule. Participants can weigh in, entertain oral arguments. I mean, it's not like we're going to have to start from square one. Somebody else just comes in, takes over the case after the other judge steps down. The case continues. I don't know how much more there's going to be left after oral arguments to get to a verdict, but that's the part that I think is good too, that there's already been the process in place. We're already at this point, we're close to the finish line, and I don't think there's anything, as we said before, that would preclude the DEA to go and say, no, we're not going to go and go with what the HHS said, regardless of what they said. I don't think we're going to get some kind of turnaround. I think it was always about a matter of time. So we didn't get it in 2024. But I think maybe by the end of this year, we could see a ruling finally come to it, and hopefully in our favor.
Yes. You know, again, that whole process with the ALJ was unfortunate. It was unfortunate that it got stalled. But, you know, there are many people that think the fact that Mulrooney has now stepped down and there is no longer an ALJ and that it's back in Cole's hands, that means it's back into more of an administrative process rather than a legal process that could be drawn out over months and months and months. So the real optimists in the sector are saying, boy, this really plays into the Trump administration's hand in being able to get something done quickly and not have to wait for a legal process to play itself out over months and months and months. But, you know, we shall see.
Also, as we're going in right now to break, I just want to make sure that make mention of one of the things that had caught me before we were getting this interview scheduled was one of the main advocates I've seen for many years, going back to the first campaign run for President Trump, Bruce Lavelle, put out a post saying, should President Trump reschedule cannabis? And it did get quite a bit. And you did mention about why it should. 90% of Americans believe medical cannabis should be legal, according to Pew and Gallup poll. Rescheduling the three could help federal authorities pursue TCOs, exploiting the state federal disconnect of cannabis laws, and allowing for more research so we have definitive data about the positive effects millions of Americans are experiencing around opioid and alcohol abuse reduction, not to mention aiding cancer patients as well as our veterans for PTSD and anxiety are dealing with. The other thing we would talk about enough is, I mean, if I'm correct, the DEA, isn't that still under the purview of Bobby Kennedy at HHS? So I haven't heard what he has. I mean, I know he's been very supportive for cannabis and psychedelics, but we haven't heard from Bobby Kennedy in terms of directing Administrator Cole to move forward on this as well. That's the other part that I think we're also missing out on, is that we haven't heard from him and where he goes with it. I mean, obviously, that director, Kennedy, has been very busy on other things, and I really like what he's been doing. But this is an area where it's just, where is this in the queue?
Yeah. So, yes, we in the industry would all love to see statements of support, right? Because that's going to make us feel good. But if you step back and you put yourself into Kennedy's shoes, he doesn't actually have to do anything. In other words, it's been done already. The report is there. The report is on the record. Nobody's refuting the report. He doesn't need to defend the report. It's there. So, you know, if I were him, I'd say, well, what is it you do want me to do? I don't need to do anything because the HHS has done it. If anything, he's doing something by doing nothing. And what I mean by that is that he's not rescinding the report. He's not coming out saying, I disagree with the previous administration. The report has been submitted. And we always have to remember, there is a proposed rule that's on the books. So the government has already said, we intend to do this. Please comment. Right. It's not that we're thinking of doing this. Maybe we'll do this. Boy, possibly we'll do this. So we are going to do this. Please comment. Now we have to wait for the final rule. So you don't need HHS to weigh in at this point. It already did that. And so the fact that that Kennedy has not come out and said anything in support isn't worrisome on its surface. Of course, we always would love to hear, you know, positive things out of an administration official. But given the laundry list of priorities that all of these people have, if you don't have to do something, why go wading into it?
When we come back, I want to go ahead and talk about where Senator Rand Paul, we were talking about this before we got on, the fact that now there's the threat of blocking passage of a bill over language he would claim would destroy the hemp industry. Hemp Hangridge from the agriculture funding bill that, you know, has been out there for quite a bit. We're going to talk about that. And also just what are the implications that are going to happen once we get the rescheduling, and just make the case once again why we need to go and see this going forward. We should be cautious. Oh my God, I'm going to say it now. Cautiously optimistic. But I'm not going to say cautiously. I'm going to say hopefully optimistic. I really believe it's just a matter of process. It's just protocol. You know, the Congress is moving the way it does. But I think if there's one thing that this president does, he likes to go ahead and push the ball along. He got his big, beautiful bill done. That was the major hurdle that had to get crossed. Now let's see what they get to. And of course, there's always been bills put out there, presentations about some kind of setup for cannabis legalization or financing, banking reform, all these things. It's just a matter of where do they fall in the queue? And, you know, we have to look for that, as opposed to maybe in other times where maybe lobbying money would really be very important, which there's not a lot of to get policymakers to move forward. But I think when you have an administration and the people that are in that cabinet, to hell with lobbying. We just need to get stuff done. That's what has to happen.
Okay. That's right. And you talked about Bruce Lavelle and his post from earlier this week. I think another thing that's getting people excited are the influencers that are in social media supporting this president, tweeting out or Xing out support for rescheduling. And that's gotten a lot of attention. In fact, Bruce Lavelle, an advisor to President Trump last week, not only put out, do people support rescheduling? He came out with a later tweet that said, should we reschedule or deschedule? He went even farther in his tweet. And when I look at all those replies, we did an analysis, overwhelmingly supportive. 85 to 90% of the comments were in support. And he even then put another tweet out shortly after that, said, "Hey, chat, are we bullish on?" And he had an icon which represents weed. Are we bullish on weed? Again, more support. So a lot of people think that these are trial balloons being put out there, testing the waters to see what the base says so that this administration can get behind rescheduling. And the last thing is, let's not forget also that Trump pardoned Weldon Angelos. And Weldon is a great advocate for this sector and great advocate for clemency and for righting the wrongs that have happened to people through the years through prohibition.
He has an ear to the president. We can see where they're going to go with that, but we're going to go into more of all this coming up here with Anthony Coniglio, CEO of Newlay Capital Partners here in Blunt Business. Again, powered by the Buzz CRM. I'll just say this real quick, just to get the ad done today. Close deals, automation, workflows. Listen, I use it. You should too. It's very easy to use. Put as many people as you need from your team on the platform to get marketing automation done. Get everything that you need done. Website building, all of it is done for you. 500 modules that work with so many different existing systems that can be under one roof. TheBuzzCRM.com. TheBuzzCRM.com. Go ahead and sign up today. Low barrier of entry. Trust me, if I can use it, you should have it. We're right back. More with Anthony and more questions after this. Welcome back to Boom Business. I'm here with Anthony Coniglio, CEO of Newlay Capital Partners. So before the break, we have mentioned now that, according to Politico, I'm taking from, that senators are agreeing to strip hemp language from the Agriculture Appropriations Bill. Senator Rand Paul of Kentucky has previously threatened to block passage of the bill over language he would say would destroy the hemp industry. And now has been a long time clash between Senator Mitch McConnell and Rand Paul over this issue. And Mitch McConnell responsible for the implementation of the 2018 Farm Bill that we had put forward. So what's been said to the, according to the subcommittee chair for the Senate Appropriations Agriculture or FDA, John Hoven, has said that there was the thoughts of the provision could be removed after Rand Paul threatened to block Senate passage of the bill entirely. And the loophole was allowing hemp producers to create intoxicating products without being subject to rules or taxes as cannabis. However, it opened the floodgates to unregulated production of intoxicating products across the country. So that loophole brought in, of course, everybody was happy to go and see that. We saw that there's been, you know, a lot of companies and places where you can buy those products that have been the point of contention. And because of that, from the state aspect, we know that states like Tennessee, Texas is currently looking at it as well. They're putting bills in front. First, it was the crackdown on Delta 8, Delta 9. Now they're just going after all synthetics altogether. And from a national level, we might see this as well. And that's where Senator Paul is talking from as well. When you look at this point right here, you know, I mean, he's got a lot of pull, so he's trying to go ahead and kind of sway the vote. What do you think about what's being brought up so far and where we are with it?
It tells me that this is extremely political to have senators from the same state pushing and pulling so hard on this one issue. The farm lobby is very strong, and I'd say the hemp lobby has proven to be strong as well. You still have a House version of the ag bill that does have that provision in. There'll be a reconciliation. Clearly, this will be a difference between the two. And it could be that you still get that ban coming back in reconciliation, but you need Rand Paul's vote to get this passed and off the floor of the Senate. So it remains to be seen. What I would say is beyond the federal government, you do have states continuing to focus on synthetic THC. Now, what Rand Paul has said is not that he supports synthetic THC, or supports what people call gas station weed. What he said is he's worried about the Kentucky farmers and that this bill would destroy the Kentucky farmers. So you could see continued work and language developed that gets him comfortable, but bans those synthetic products. One of the reasons I say that is because from what I've read, you have Senator McConnell, who's going to be retiring, understanding that his fingerprints are all over that 18 farm bill and getting hemp legalized, and that he's further made statements that he doesn't want part of his legacy to be the legalization of synthetic THC. And so I have to expect that him and his staff will continue to try to work out some sort of a compromise with Senator Rand Paul to provide the provisions that he wants to protect farmers, but also remove those dangerous products from shelves that aren't even age gated. And then beyond all that federal activity, you have continued state activity. Right now, as we record this, we're in the special session in Texas, and SB5 came out of committee banning these synthetic products, and we expect it to pass the full Senate. We'll see what happens over in the House. But you're certainly hearing a story coming out of Governor Abbott that he wants a bill that eliminates these synthetic products but doesn't hurt hemp as a crop, as a viable crop for non-psychoactive purposes. So I think we're going to continue to see this pushback against these synthetic hemp products, while you can support hemp farmers for textiles and other uses, traditional uses for hemp, just not this synthetic THC.
And point the two words you said right there, short session. We should be able to get an answer for this. That Senate bill is going to pass, and I guess the Governor Abbott's desk to sign. But let's go back to where it all started. So there was federal inaction that's already been said about why we're even seeing right now with the appropriations with this, the particular committee with the FDA. What has not happened, the states have decided to go ahead and take the initiative. So first of all, with September of last year, the California Department of Public Health started putting emergency regulations, banning. Then, you know, Governor Newsom comes in here and we have a bill coming into place to ban intoxicating THC. That was the first thing we came across. U.S. Hemp Roundtable went in court against the Department of Public Health and, you know, couldn't get anything to move forward right now. If they're trying to say if the bill tries to stay in effect, Virginia's had the same issue where hemp businesses have been challenging the state's 2023 law, which capped THC at a certain level. again, we've talked about Tennessee. Again, we talked about Texas. And you know, right now, we also look at Arkansas, that house that had this, but it was an overturned injunction. And if the bill were to be brought forward, the Senate bill passing, Governor Abbott is already saying that he would, his veto reasoning could be that he would cite the now overturned Arkansas injunction, that it, signing a ban would mire Texas in litigation for years, just like Arkansas just went. The Eighth Circuit upheld Arkansas's law, and right now, again, Governor Abbott's going through this session to try to again get this regulatory framework in place. So, no matter what is it about the states that they feel like they had to go and get something done here? And, you know, if we had to go ahead and look at the devil's advocate and just understand the hemp producers and their argument as to why they want to crack down on hemp-derived THC.
Yes, and it is very state by state, and different states are taking different approaches. Let me answer that last question first. I think why you see states trying to crack down on hemp-derived THC is the lack of age gating and the testing that we're seeing coming out that shows contaminants, illegal and unhealthy level of contaminants in those products. And I think it just starts and stops right there. I think it's about public safety, and I think it's about age gating. And it's really hard for anybody, and quite frankly, I've not come across anybody who's defended the age gating, even within the hemp community. What I hear most out of that community is, okay, well, then let's talk about regulation. Nobody's defending the lack of age gating. Nobody's defending the unhealthy contaminants that are found in the products. With respect to the states and the different approaches, you know, every state's taking it differently. I think a fascinating one to look at is Florida. You had the House and the Senate in Florida pass bans last year, only to see, as we all famously know, Governor DeSantis veto them. You know, it was amazing when you think about it, and then we understand now some of the political reasons that he did that.
I think he's looking at a presidential run, and that's why he's also following the same thing when it comes to Texas. Why he's following along and seeing what Texas is doing when it comes to redistricting, which is what's been pushed forward as a priority, which should be a priority in that state, because a lot of people are wondering what the elections are going to look like in next year for the midterms. They're looking at that. And then for the presidential aspirations for DeSantis, he's looking at, okay, well, we're going to redistrict first. And you know what? We also need to go and worry about the T part first as well.
Yes, and veto. And so what did they do in Florida? They implemented new rules in March of this year, stricter labeling, packaging, and stricter advertising standards. And that's the way they're going at it. So he vetoed the hemp ban, but yet his people within the administration are enforcing an effective hemp ban because the labeling and the disclosure requirements, and that's the way they're getting there. So they're not saying that the products are illegal. They're saying that they have this de facto regulatory regime without actually setting up the regulations and saying you need to comply with the labeling and the packaging and the advertising standards. And many of the hemp operators in Florida are failing that, and therefore you're seeing a lot of enforcement action. So this hemp story isn't going away. I think it's going to be with us for another couple of years, but I think it's important to the state legal business, because the average consumer doesn't really know the difference between the THC product that they're buying in a smoke shop and the THC product that they're buying in their dispensary. I think many people say cannabis is now legal in my state. I used to have to go to a dispensary, but hey, I guess maybe they changed the rules and now I could go to a smoke shop or a gas station. They just continue to purchase it. Doesn't mean they're dumb at all. People don't pay attention to it the way we do. And so I think the state legal operators are losing a fair amount of business to this hemp-derived product. And the faster we can get some regulation around it, we can get these products off the shelves that don't have age gating, put them back into the regulated environment like dispensaries where they should be, that's when I think we'll see a return to growth for some of these markets for the state legal businesses.
Going to go one more break, but when we come back, I also want to bring up one other piece of news that I saw coming across in the headlines that also very promising that we can keep an eye on. Again, we're just trying to go and find and dig up some very hopeful, wishful, but and I'm not trying to go and just give out, you know, some, I am not trying to do lip service on this program. I am trying to, along with Anthony here, trying to go and dissect certain things that are happening right now, certain movements that are going on that benefit cannabis, And to look at that and say, you know what? There is reason for us to go and pay attention again. Hear our eyes again. Our antennas should be laser focused on what's happening here, because there are some things that are happening. We have a lot of processes and protocol in place. And one of the appointment has been brought up right now that might be very promising. We're going to talk about that here with Anthony Coniglio, CEO of New Lake Capital Partners, here on Blunt Business after a short break. Wrapping up our conversation with Anthony Coniglio, CEO of New Lake Capital Partners, here on Blunt Business. Their marijuana moment on their headlines right now. They have President Trump has thrown his support behind Florida State Senator Joe Gruters, who was previously the leader of the Republican Party of Florida. He's now being looked at as the new leader of the Republican National Committee. He is being endorsed by now by President Trump to be chairman, and he will be replacing the chairman right now, Michael Whatley, who is going to be running for a U.S. Senate seat representing North Carolina. So what we've learned is that this particular state senator, Joe Gruters, who's Republican, is a vocal proponent of marijuana legalization. And in that case right there would be wonderful. He's been critical of the governor. While he's been, Governor DeSantis was critical of the advocacy for cannabis legalization, though last year's Amendment 3 that would have legalized and regulated cannabis for adults in the state did not go through. But Gruters was in support of that. And what he did also, what they will say as well, that he also sided with the campaign that was behind MSL True Leaf and Smart and Safe Florida to push that forward. So, you know, while Republicans can go ahead and agree to disagree on certain things, one of the areas might be cannabis. We know that this is a pro-cannabis person to lead the RNC, which is going to be in control of the funding and the mechanism to place in senators and representatives representing all over the country with hopefully cannabis stances. What do you think?
I know we're supposed to be optimistic here. I'm not as optimistic that cannabis will be central to Gruters' role in the RNC. If you think about what his charge is, his charge in that role is to get Republicans elected. And so they are going, and he's going to be doing a grassroots oriented analysis of what's going to get each Congress member and each senator reelected or elected in the next cycle. And maybe cannabis will be an issue in some of those. Heretofore, it hasn't been an issue that gets somebody elected or keeps somebody from getting elected. Certainly, it's great to have a guy like that in that position, because if the topic comes up, he can certainly be an advocate and a supporter, right? Better than a prohibitionist. But when I really think about what his job is going to be, it's going to be about winning primaries for the right candidates and getting the right candidates going up against their Democratic competitors or the other side of the ticket and getting people elected. And on the national stage, the issues, I think, are going to be away from cannabis. I think they're going to be about economy, going to be about the border, going to be about health care, fiscal policy, all the major national political topics that we see in the headlines so far this year, national security.
But what I always keep reading about for certain people that are either advocates or surrogates for the president, they've always said about the fact that it's never where, you know, people are offering advice to Trump. It's always Trump asking for advice. He always wants to hear what people have to say about certain things. So that's one of the things where, according to what Gruters told the Marijuana Moment, he said that there have been people that try to go and say that when he did advocate and he did say things good about medical marijuana legalization in Florida, that was a good move. That was possibly enough that was going to sway the vote for Amendment 3 in Florida to get adult use in. But according to what he said to Marijuana Moment, he also said that, like any major policy decision, he's going to get input from lots of people, but he's thankful to be in the circle where he can offer his opinion and he thinks he value it. So right, to have a voice that's got close, that's going to be very important to him coming up to the midterm elections, if he is appointed the RNC chairman, that's the thing, is that we have more people that are getting around that will put that kind of thought process in play. If there's just more people are actually at least trying to talk about and a pro stance.
I totally agree. It's always better to have people in the orbit of the president supportive of cannabis. And one place where Gruters could be helpful as RNC chair is to say that cannabis reform would be supportive of the ticket in general, as opposed to somebody saying, oh my gosh, stay away from that topic. That's toxic to our opportunity to accomplish our goals in the next midterms. And so Gruters might be somebody that's more interested in the data around young voter support and where that could be really helpful. And what does the data look like on a state-by-state basis and district-by-district basis in terms of supporting cannabis reform? And does that help this administration present itself and the Republican ticket at large as supportive of these types of reforms? I also think, you know, just we don't often talk enough about the narrative change for the Republican Party to be seen as the champion of this type of reform. There's always that saying, this is not your father's party. This is not your father's or mother's Republican Party, to see them come out and actually embrace cannabis if they ultimately do that. But that really does kind of change the narrative from a young person's perspective, where historically younger people have looked at the Republican Party as a more stodgy, older, highly conservative party. And to see the party come out and support this type of reform could have an impact on young voters beyond just the next election cycle, but it could help reframe the party as a whole. That's all optimistic thinking for you.
Oh, exactly. But I mean, I think we put enough out there to support, at least there's enough for us to go and get back to paying attention to what's going on and see if there's an approach where a couple of things can still happen. I mean, it's just a matter of where, if the government is moving and operating at a pace that it's supposed to be without any obstructions, without any issues at all. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's what we have to go and look forward to. We know cannabis is in the purview of all this here. It's where it stands in the queue, where it can move forward. And, you know, right. I know we'll come back to this and we'll do this in a few months and see if we get any progress on this. I hope to go ahead and have some to report and talk about it.
Well, if we do get progress, have me back so we could celebrate, because I'd love to celebrate with you.
I agree. And I hope we do. Really hooking hope of that. Website is newlake.com, newlake.com. N-E-W-L-A-K-E. And of course, your team, industry leading real estate portfolio and a growth oriented industry for cannabis real estate capital. Take a minute to go and tell people about the website and for those that might be interested in working with your team and maybe working on some funding efforts.
Oh, well, listen, thank you. Thank you very much for the opportunity to do that. So at New Lake, we're the second largest owner of cannabis real estate in the U.S. We own cultivation facilities and dispensaries across the country. Our tenants are some of the leading companies in the industry, like a Curaleaf, a Cresco, or Trulieve, as well as we also do business with smaller multi-state operators. We love the business. We've been at it for almost 7 years and we're going strong, and we look forward to continuing to serve the industry's real estate needs.
And just make point as well, we have talked to Anthony many times. So when it comes to New Lake and what they do in terms of the real estate options and what we've done with the portfolio, we've talked plenty of times about that here on the program. Just go back and do a search and you'll see that we've gotten a chance to go talk all about that. But there was just so much pressing that we had to go talk about today. And Anthony, I appreciate having your ear and your voice to go and help talk about this issue and go and bring this out to the forefront. Thanks again for all, as always, for bringing time for us.
Thanks so much for having me. I love doing these chats with you.
Anthony Coniglio, CEO of New Lake Capital Partners here in Blunt Business. And thank you for listening, folks, for another Blunt Business. And hopefully, you know, we're looking a little more on the bright side of life, quoting Monty Python and the Holy Grail. So thanks for joining us for once again. We'll talk to you next time.
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/PODKATZ13. Just go to Indeed.com/PODKATZ13 KATZ13 right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
Life is a workout, and Smoothie King is here to help you power through. Whether you're crushing morning miles or sprinting through back-to-back meetings, give your body the energy, protein, and power it needs to help you conquer your goals, only at Smoothie King.